You're listening to Let's Talk Macro,
brought to you by Bandhan Mutual Fund.
Hello there and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Macro. As I'm sure you've caught on by now, this is a podcast series on macroeconomics by Bandhan Mutual Fund. You're here with me, Neerja. I'm briefly stepping in for Ahalya, who isn't here, but I am more than happy to take over and enter this very interesting world where we discuss both global and domestic macroeconomics. These are things that have an impact on our lives. How small or how profound of an impact is something that we're calling upon our expert to decipher, Srijit Balasubramanian, economist in the fixed income fund management team, joins us once again. Hi, Srijit. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Neerja. How are you doing?
I'm good. How about you?
Good. Thank you.
Well, a very happy new year, first off. Let me start with that to you and everyone listening in. And Srijit, now is the time, isn't it, to look back at the previous year and learn from it, make improvements. Certainly something that applies to all walks of life. But today, Srijit, we'll stay away from personal revelations and rather look at revealing some insights on the global and domestic economy. Talk about what we've learned from the year gone by and what some of the key themes are in 2024. So Srijit, perhaps it's best to begin with a quick summary for our listeners of what transpired in 2023. How do you think the global economy played out?
Sure. First, I hope all the listeners of Let's Talk Macro had a fantastic holiday season. I wish everyone a very happy, healthy, peaceful and successful new year. So let's begin with the global economy. You know, maybe we'll start with the advanced economies like the US and Europe first. So if you look at some of the key numbers, the US economy has clearly made progress in terms of better balance, although obviously it's not yet fully back to pre-pandemic trends or levels consistent with the 2% inflation target. So essentially, it's a work in progress. Now, the Fed hiked policy rates by 100 basis points during the year in 2023. CPI inflation we have seen go from 6.5% at end of 2022 to 3.1% now. Now, goods disinflation, including the energy, has been the main factor here, while services have further room to ease. Easing of supply side bottlenecks and base effects have also helped. This progress was achieved without a meaningful rise in the unemployment rate, which was 3.5% 1 year ago and is at 3.7% in the latest reading. Labor supply, however, has been improving. So growth in general kept surprising to the upside, despite monetary policy tightening and broad money supply growth turning negative. The main reason for this, like we have discussed before, has been the US fiscal policy, which provided massive rounds of stimulus during the pandemic and created excess household savings. And I think we've talked about it quite a bit before. But fiscal continues to stay elevated than pre-pandemic in the US, and it's projected to stay so even after a decade if you look at the projections. The euro area, on the other hand, witnessed much weaker growth in consumer sentiment. Germany, for instance, which is manufacturing intensive, reported quite weak numbers. Fiscal stimulus there was lesser and lesser compared to the US, and inflation has also been easing, with energy prices and related government support measures coming off the equation. But the labor market, even there, the unemployment rate and wage growth is still quite tight and not fully back in balance. That's what it is on the US and the Europe economic situation. But if you look at monetary policy in general, roughly the first half of 2023 was about central banks continuing with rate hikes, although the quantum was dialed down. And there were some hiccups from the banking sector stress in the US as financial stability came to the forefront. But this was prevented from becoming a major crisis. Subsequently, if you remember, there was a change in language from both the Fed and the ECB to suggest further tightening will be done only as appropriate. So the second half then was all about discovery of peak rates. Markets had anticipated some easing last year itself, but central banks continue to push back strongly against this and any loosening in financial conditions by sort of sticking to their higher for longer narrative. Interestingly, if you look at the treasury bond yields in the US, let's say the 10-year or the 2-year, 10-year and 3-year rates, they're all very similar now to what they were a year ago. But the story of the year is actually hidden there between these similar readings from 2022 and now. Take the 10-year and 30-year yields, for instance. They've witnessed dramatic moves, increasing by over 100 basis points each, as central banks stuck to their hawkish narrative and even higher fiscal deficit and borrowing was reassessed by the market, particularly during the September-October period. Now, these moves have mostly unwound, gathering pace, particularly after the recent Fed pivot in December, which we'll come to in a bit. But rates now are obviously still well above the pre-pandemic rates. Now, Most of the advanced economies also had a similar story through the year, with progress on disinflation, growth slowdown to varying degrees, but policy rates now, you know, at or near peak. Some of them, like the Euro area and UK, also had downward inflation surprises very recently. But if you look at it, part of it is temporary. The labor markets are still somewhat tight there. And so central banks have mostly left rates unchanged in their latest meetings. And they haven't really started discussing rate cuts like the Fed. One central bank that really stands out among advanced economies is, of course, the Bank of Japan, which deals with a very different domestic economy. It has stuck to its negative interest rate policy and yield curve control, although with a tweak in October. But there is a wide expectation of it to exit these sometime in 2024. Because inflation has finally moved up after years of deflation. You know, but the question is really the sustainability of that inflation. So, in short, a similar story across advanced economies, except for the Fed's December pivot and the, you know, the Bank of Japan's policy. Yeah, that's how you would put it.
Right. So quite a similar path that advanced economy central banks have traversed in 2023, yeah. Of course, with different levels of progress on inflation. Srijit, the one economy we cannot leave out when we're discussing global economics is China, right? In fact, absolutely. I believe there was a separate episode on the series on China sometime back. So have things changed since then?
In China, the broad economic context hasn't really changed much. China was already slowing pre-pandemic due to economic deleveraging in the trade war. Then the pandemic, property sector issues, floods, power crunch and so on added to this. The 2023 economic reopening also turned out to be softer than expected, and policy support as such till date largely has been targeted. I mean, by that I mean it hasn't been large scale by any means, and it hasn't really addressed the prime reduced cost of funding. So that's where it still is, hasn't really changed much.
Okay, not a major change there in China. Well, I believe that brings us to our domestic story then. How did things play out in India and where are we now?
Sure, for India, 2023 was a year of buoyant growth. In fact, stronger than expected. But the main driver was government capital expenditure. You know, things like services trade surplus witnessed a steady rise during the year. But private demand, particularly rural demand, has not been that strong. And you know, that's reflected in lower goods trade deficit numbers and the absence of major demand-fueled inflation also in India compared to, let's say, the advanced economies like US. And if you remember, India's services inflation has been therefore much better behaved than, let's say, in the US. Overall inflation also moderated in terms of numbers towards mid-year 2023. But thereafter, it has almost entirely been about supply-driven food inflation. In multiple episodes of that, in fact. While core inflation has eased, we had price spikes in vegetables like tomatoes and onions, but generally stronger inflation in multiple food items like cereals, given this was an El Nino year, pulses, milk, spices and so on. But that's where inflation broadly is. Coming to fiscal policy, it seems to be on track now to meet the targeted fiscal deficit for this year, as tax revenues have picked up quite strongly after being initially weak, which is mostly during the early part of the year, the financial year. Monetary policy, on the other hand, in terms of interest rates, have been on hold after the February hike last year by the RBI. But the RBI has really maintained its stance of withdrawal of accommodation and the need for policy to be actively disinflationary to ensure inflation durably aligns with the 4% target. Of course, the RBI is worried about multiple rounds of food inflation, which could create second round effects and feed into inflation expectations. But after February, it has mostly used liquidity tools and macroprudential measures to influence overnight rates and credit growth, let's say. So that's where we are now on policy also. And in general, if you look at India in 2023, it has been about buoyant growth driven more by government expenditure and continuing food inflation risks.
Right, definitely. I mean, I think tomato has been the word of 2023. But what we're seeing is a similar theme across most advanced economies, but specific domestic macro themes in Japan, China and India. Right. Srijit, from tracking all these economies, what have really been the key learnings for you from 2023?
The obvious learning or challenge in 2023, so to say, was understanding the dynamics and drivers of key variables that they shape monetary policy reaction. Now, take the case of inflation and labor market in the US, for example. To decipher trends and components, the interaction among variables, get feelers of their path, and thus let's say the balance of probabilities and risks for policy have been equally interesting and challenging. In that context, if you ask me, separating structural and cyclical trends becomes very important. know, for example, you know, we see that quite obviously in the case of Japan. You know, these are some of the learnings, I would say, but there are also some, let's say, specific takeaways. So one, the challenge in central bank policy communication, you know, it has been very obvious in 2023, you know, in an uncertain environment where the central bank is not sure where the new supply-demand balance and various variables like for inflation, labor market, etc. But that said, the learning is also that talking about concurrent data as a guide to policy reaction, which is also something that we have seen in 2023, you know, without considering the lags of policy transmission fully, can cause considerable market volatility. So that's been an important learning. The other learning, you know, I would say, is probably the debate on the trade-off between price stability and financial stability. Take the U.S. you know, banking sector stress from March here, for example. You know, the Fed is hiking rates while, you know, macroprudential and liquidity tools were used to prevent the banking issue from snowballing into a full-fledged crisis and cause financial instability. So the tools they used to achieve price stability and financial stability were different. But if you look at the debate of a trade-off, I think there's really no trade-off, especially in the medium to long term, because financial stability is always a prerequisite. I think these would probably be the two main learnings I would take away from 2023, from what I remember. Yeah.
Okay, now we've looked back at 2023 and some of the learnings. Always a good idea to do that. But also, perhaps right now, it's time to look forward at what to track in 2024. So what are some of those things, Srijit, the key things that you should all keep tabs on?
Sure. I don't want to give a big list here of all the variables we track, but the obvious stuff is, you know, growth, particularly in the US, as to how much and how fast it slows after a stronger than expected year. Inflation, how the next leg of disinflation progresses in advanced economies. So how much more does services inflation slow, and whether the recent better data in the US and Europe continues or does it reverse? Labor market, as to, you know, how rebalancing continues there, like wage growth trends, wage negotiations in Europe and Japan particularly, which have important implications for inflation and monetary policy. These are the obvious ones, but we'll also have to see how fast, how much, and how broad the progress is. The other interesting aspect will be the lagged impact of rate hikes already done, and likely further tightening of credit standards, let's say on one side, versus the loosening of financial conditions that we've been witnessing more recently, and any risk of, let's say, inflation reaccelerating, if it happens, on the other side. So the Fed pivoted in December by shifting from higher for longer to discussing rate cuts. The markets have then moved ahead of the Fed's projection, which is of 75 basis points of rate cuts in 2024. So we'll have to see, you know, one, further progress on labor markets and sustainably lower inflation. And secondly, the impact of financial conditions, which have now started to loosen a bit, versus the lagged impact of monetary policy tightening, like I said. Refinancing of some of the corporate borrowings will happen next year, and that will now be at a rate lower than a few weeks ago, but it will still be much higher than their existing borrowing rates. This will be important, especially in the US, where monetary policy transmission so far has been, you know, lesser than some of the other developed countries, because US has a much lower share of variable rate borrowing. The other thing would be, you know, let's say commercial real estate, which has been in some distress, and, you know, corporate insolvencies have inched up a bit, but this has so far been lower than in previous downturns, given, you know, the pandemic-related support that corporates received and the cash that they've accumulated. So all this sort of together decides whether the US economy lands softly or experiences a recession, and, you know, if so, the extent of it. Mm-hmm. For Europe, we'll see, you know, how much, or rather how the much weaker growth, but the buoyant wage growth situation evolves. So wage growth, particularly for retained employees, is still strong there. And this creates cost pressures for companies, as, you know, we also seen in some of the recent PMI component data. This is particularly so for services, which is more labor intensive and is the one for which inflation needs to fall further, right? So we'll have to especially see the data in the first half of 2024 this year, because the ECB has quite a strong forecast, if you see, with productivity and growth improving and the unemployment rate hardly rising. So we'll have to see whether the ECB lowers their forecast or not, because, you know, growth as of now is really weak. For Japan, like I mentioned earlier, any signs of a sustainable rise in inflation through a wage price cycle, and so the wage negotiations this year, you know, in that sense will be really important. Exit from negative interest rate and yield curve control policies will also depend on this, although this is now more a question of when and not, you know, whether. That would be mostly on advanced economies. On emerging markets, you know, if you look at most of the economies, most of which are close to, you know, at or close to peak rates, the biggest factor was higher for longer rates in advanced economies, in a sense, right? Like in the US and Europe. So the Fed pivot is welcome, and the weakness in the US dollar generally makes financial conditions easier. But the other side is that the export growth there will depend on advanced economies in China, no? The growth there, rather, where the growth is not expected to rebound materially. The big domestic risk is, of course, higher food and energy prices, because this could complicate monetary policy in case of second round effects. And although some countries, especially Southeast Asian countries, have government subsidies. So this is broadly the case. I'm just trying to give you a little bit of general idea about EMs. But there are also countries like Argentina, for example, which is dealing with very high inflation as we speak and an economic crisis. So the government there devalued the peso exchange rate by over 50% in one shot. You know, they've cut jobs, public projects and subsidies and so on. So that's also happening on one side. For China, again, big bang or consumer-centric policies will be the key. Easier developed market rates will help China because China is also easy. On India, we've talked about the public capex cycle, you know, being the major driver. So whether a private capex cycle evolves from the current public sector heavy situation, how private consumption moves given rural economy and wage growth are not really strong, how the higher trade services, the services trade surplus, which has actually helped reduce the current account deficit, going strong, how that moves as the developed world slows or the growth there slows will all be important to see. The big risk, of course, is again food inflation. And this has been highlighted in the minutes of the RBI's Monetary Policy Committee meeting in December also. And if you look at monetary policy, a shift in the stance and rate cuts, you know, eventually to calibrate real rates are expected, but that's later in the year. But the question there is again, how much, you know, assuming no major economic accidents in the world. So that's a broad summary of things that we would like to track in advanced economies and emerging markets.
Right. Well, it's great that you've given us such a thorough overview of all that 2024 holds for some of the major economies. Srijit, it's also possible that we are in for another year of markets versus central banks. Are we right to expect that situation? Is that what you think as well? Or do you think it's going to be something else this time?
Yeah, well, that'll be the case in a sense because, like I said, we are at or close to peak rates, right? So the Fed has pivoted and the markets have already moved ahead in the timing on the timing and magnitude of rate cuts this year. So all the data we discussed, whether we see progress or not, especially in the early part of the year, let's say the first half, will become inputs to how central banks and markets sort of adjust their projections. So this time, so in a sense, it'll be markets versus central banks. But this time, apart from that, we could also see a bit of central banks versus central banks. Because, you know, there could be divergence among the central banks on the timing and magnitude of cuts, depending on inflation, labor markets and growth. So we currently see that in the more hawkish comments from the ECB and the Bank of England, right? And even some of the other central banks versus that of the Fed, which has actually said that they've already started discussing rate cuts. And as we move further down the road, you know, inflation expectations, longer term neutral rate and so on will start getting discussed more. As you know, each economy assesses whether there have been any structural changes, how much to cut policy rates, therefore, and so on. On this, barring any surprises, compared to emerging markets like India, advanced economies will obviously have more space as they hiked much more above their neutral rates. That's one thing. The other thing is also that it could also be fiscal policy versus monetary policy in some countries. Now, I'm not saying they're going to be at odds, but we'll have to basically track the incremental growth impulse from fiscal policies, especially food and energy support measures. Now, this is coming at a time when central banks are still in that fight for price stability. So even in the US and Europe, you know, fiscal will continue to be important. And we have seen how long and treasury bond yields increased last year as a response to not just policy rate expectations, but higher borrowing also. So fiscal will be one important metric to track how that evolves. And see, ultimately, if you see, it's all supply versus demand, you know, whichever economy, sector or variable you take, from goods and commodities where possibly geopolitical tensions, for example, can impact supply and you know, global growth can impact demand, to other sectors like, you know, housing or even labor markets and inflation, you know, are all about this supply versus demand, right? So let's essentially, I think what we need to do is we hope for better balance in all of these, but we'll have to see if that balance itself, you know, eventually is going to be in line with pre-pandemic trends, or you know, whether there have been structural shifts which become more apparent going ahead. But that's down the line.
Yeah. Well, a very comprehensive and insightful way to kick off 2024. I must say we're off to a great start here on Let's Talk Macro. It may be hard to come up with resolutions around this time, but at least we are equipped with some knowledge for the year. Srijit, we've laid out the assessments and learnings from 2023 and the key areas we'll be tracking in 2024. Very, very useful as we prepare for the rest of the year. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, and I wish everyone a very happy new year again.
Very happy new year right back at you and to everybody listening in. That's it from us today. We'll be back soon with another episode of Let's Talk Macro. Until then, it's bye-bye for now.
Mutual fund investments are subject to market risks. Read all scheme-related documents carefully.